Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. It's wonderful to be here with you today. I'm Robert Colville, the director of the Centre for Policy Studies think tank, and we're here to discuss essentially the most important number in British politics and society today, which is 1.3. And that is the figure which the Office for Budget Responsibility estimates growth will go back to in 2024 after the pandemic rebound is over, followed by some similarly terrifying numbers like 1.6, 1.7. This fits what is frankly a dismal pattern of low productivity, low investment, and low growth in the UK. And while levelling up matters, and the NHS and social care matter, and being able to bail people out during energy price spikes all matter, the only way we pay for any of them is via growth, as I think Tony is going to explain. And just to make everyone feel even more miserable, this isn't a problem that started with this government. It's not a problem that started with Brexit. It's not a problem that started with the financial crisis. If you go back to the 1980s, GDP growth per capita, just to take immigration out of it, was 2.5% a year on average. In the 1990s, it was 1.9%. In the 2000s, 1.2%, partly because of a little something called the financial crisis. In the 2010s, 1.1%. So if we imagine ourselves in an Indiana Jones movie, we're in that scene where the ceiling just starts to descend and descend and descend, and we're sort of looking up in horror, and it feels like there's nothing we can do. This is why, from our perspective at the CPS, it's never been more important to think big and radical thoughts about growth. In our view, that means being vehemently and viciously pro-business, pro-entrepreneurship, pro-enterprise as the only thing that can really drive growth. And it's a kind of meeting of minds on that, which is why we're here doing this event, because basically Tony and I started talking about this and kind of agreed completely that this is the key challenge that the country faces. So for his speech today, Tony will be donning his metaphorical bullwhip and fedora to explain how we get out of this trap, how we escape the doom that is slowly afflicting the economy, is condemning us to high growth, high tax, and high spending. Please join me in welcoming the man of the hour, Mr. Tony Duncan.
Thank you, Robert. Welcome, everybody. Those of you here in the room at the CBI HQ, and those of you at home in your pajamas. We know you're wearing your pyjamas, but it's our secret. It's a real pleasure, Robert, to collaborate with you and the brilliant Centre for Policy Studies on today's event. I don't know if you know the CPS logo, but it's basically a dartboard, because your thinking always hits the bullseye. Right? Although I think it looks very much like the Jam logo, for those of you old enough to remember, which makes you the Paul Weller of modern conservative thought, which is a comparison you're not wild about, given Paul Weller's politics. But I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Anybody that follows topics like these will read Robert's brilliant column in the Sunday Times, as I do every week. Today we do need to talk about growth. As you said, labour shortages, supply chain problems, energy prices soaring. More about that from the Chancellor in a moment. Inflation outstripping wages. That's why we need to talk about growth. This is 1 year after we fully left the European Union. And Brexit was a two-part plan. The first bit was supposed to be the easy bit, where we leave. And the second bit was all about growth, higher competitiveness than ever before, unleashing the hidden potential of Britain. And on that front, we really haven't got started yet. And look, I am a big believer in post-Brexit Britain. I think it gives us the burning platform we need to push the UK's huge economic potential. I think it gives us the freedoms to place our own bets. It gives us the opening to lead the world on modern regulation. And it can awaken us from the flatlining productivity that took hold after the financial crisis. But that is not where we are currently headed. Now, the government has a new talking point. You all will have heard it. We are the fastest growing economy in the G7. I mean, I get the spin, but I deeply hope that no one in government believes their own PR. Because let's be honest, V-shaped recoveries around black swan events like pandemics are not a time for credit or blame, right? No one is to blame for the nosedive, nor are they in credit for the bounce back. We do, however, as Robert cited, get a dose of reality from the independent OBR. And their forecast is their judgment on the UK's economic trajectory. And as Robert says, once the rebound's complete, We fall to growth of 1.3%, rising to 1.7%. And given, as Robert mentioned, that our trend growth previously had been closer to 2 and 2.5, this is not good enough. What's truly worrying for me is that, on the face of it, government seems to have accepted this forecast as the only target, the trajectory as the potential. And everything the government is doing is trying to get growing when scored by the OBR. Essentially, it just achieves a new normal of low growth. We have lowballed the UK. It's in our numbers, it's in our plans, but at the CBI, we think we can do a lot better. Of course, this becomes political very quickly, and as we saw yesterday at PMQs, every party is the party of growth now. Well, we don't do politics at the CBI. Robert will be better at that when we get talking. But I know the government really cares about growth, but there are contrasting conservative principles at play. This is a party that believes in low taxes, but also fiscal discipline. It's a party that believes in low regulation, and yet it also believes that social goals can trump that. It regulates against unhealthy foods. It keeps gas prices artificially low. Even on Brexit, we have tolerated an unbelievable increase in regulation in the short run in the interests of sovereignty, with the hope of changing that later. Now, ultimately, only politicians, not me, not us, can decide the right blend of taxes, spending, and borrowing, and only politicians can decide the right mix of regulations. But what I will say is that the current settlement isn't working. There are rising spending pressures, too much tax, and too little growth. As a great hero of mine once sang, we are caught in a trap. Let me be clear about why this is such a problem. Today's high spending, high taxes, low growth is a cycle that's very hard to get out of. Cutting spending is far from straightforward, which is, by the way, why no political party wants to do it. By the end of 2021, a record 6 million people in England were waiting for routine hospital appointments, and the IFS warns the backlog could hit 10 million as appointments that were deferred during the pandemic resurface. And there are backlogs in the courts, and there are school pupils behind on learning, and transport funding models really being squeezed. In addition, meeting the needs of an aging population in the years ahead will put even more pressure on the public purse. By our calculations, by 2030, we may need to find an additional 40 to 50 billion a year to cover the cost of an aging society. So how do we pay for that? Well, the Treasury are naturally turning to taxation. But can we really raise taxes further? The UK tax burden is set to be the highest sustained level in peacetime. On corporation tax, analysis by Robert's colleagues and the Tax Foundation shows that we're currently the 11th most competitive on OECD, mostly thanks to the super deduction. But when that ends, we will slip down to 31st place on corporation tax. And of course, the government likes to say, well, we're still very competitive on business tax by looking at the corporation tax rate. It should accept, in honesty, that that's comparing apples and pears. It doesn't include, for example, the UK's eye-watering property taxes, which are the fourth highest in the OECD. We know the evidence that raising taxes reduces growth and cutting them drives it. After all, we cut VAT to stimulate consumption. We remove road tax to stimulate the buying of electric vehicles. And of course, Robert, you and your Conservative colleagues are deep believers in lowering taxes to stimulate economic growth. Now, let's be honest, the government are in a tough spot in all of this. They say we simply can't afford to spend the things we want to spend on growth. But I say we can't afford not to, because simply put, we will not pay down today's debt, extend public services, and lower taxes on 1.6% growth. It's not going to happen. To be clear, we're not talking about growth by any means. We are talking about the right kind of growth, sustainable long-term growth based on investment, innovation, and productivity. Now, it has been the Treasury's job as an institution since the Stone Age to be skeptics of this kind of talk. But economic and fiscal policy are not the same thing. No CEO in this room puts the finance department in charge of sales or lets them alone determine strategy. Companies can't afford not to invest in growth, and nor can countries. It's also not just about money. It's about ambition, imagination, and above all, it's about the political confidence to replace incremental policy with bolder and better. So can we do it? Can we pull this off, what I describe? Well, I'll give you three reasons to believe that we can. The first is, as Robert said, we've done it before. Between 1993 and 2008, the UK market sector grew by 3% a year, twice the rate of the last decade. And it wasn't, as some say, about unsustainable bubbles in sectors like oil and property and FS. Three quarters of this growth in our work was driven by capital investment, new technologies and innovation, double what they contributed in the last decade. Second reason to believe, look at other countries who've done it. I will name one with a hint of menace, Singapore. Reduced operating costs, cut corporate tax by 10%, made big bets to spark investment, spent on infrastructure, venture capital services, low interest loans, and tax incentives. The result was an average of nearly 6% growth per year. Imagine that on the Thames. And these are the kinds of policies now being deployed today by EU countries as part of the COVID recovery fund. Look, the third reason to believe we can do it, and this for me is the most important, is that in the UK we have never, in my lifetime, had quite a moment like this. When the triple forces of the pandemic, Brexit, and the race to net zero coalesce to create a burning platform and opportunity for growth. During the pandemic, this country emerged as a global leader in life sciences. We saw three quarters of firms adopt new technologies. We saw 700,000 new businesses alone in 2020. In the wake of Brexit, we have new regulatory and tax freedoms, and we can make trade deals on our own terms. But the greatest prize of all flows from our world-leading position on decarbonization. As Mark Carney announced at COP26, there is a wall of investment to fund decarbonization, over $130 trillion of assets, and a big chunk of that is in London. And this isn't about woke, it's about wealth. And British businesses are begging Conservative politicians to see the enormous prizes available for companies and countries that move fast. So all this means, this is our moment. In my last job at Be The Business, working on UK productivity, I started to get down. I became a doubter. I thought, God, is low productivity, low growth, low investment, is that endemic in UK economic life? What I felt at the time was somehow we needed a shock. We needed some jump leads. Well, we now have three. Brexit, COVID, net zero. It is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to change the trajectory of the British economy. Every CEO I speak to says it. It's also why I took this job. So, what do we do about it? Well, the government does have a plan today, but it's a plan only for 1.6%. It's a plan that increases business taxes massively without the release for investment following suit. It's a plan that funds green investment more than the pass, but less than our international competitors. It's a plan that funds an inflexible apprenticeship levy program while skill shortages continue to hinder growth. It's a plan that stops immigration for the skills we need, but offers no alternative to get them here. Now, there are plenty of exceptions to this rule, moments where this government really has made bold interventions in pursuit of better growth. The super deduction was a super exception to normal incremental thinking. It was the boldness we need. Now, the 2023 end date is too soon for most investment cycles. So not only does it need extending, it needs to represent a totally new way of thinking about business investment. The offshore wind market, with its contracts for difference, was the moment the UK government realized that it's not just about public expenditure. They could use their balance sheet to unlock high-growth private sector markets. The adoption in the budget in October of skills boot camps was the government realizing how the world of skills really operates in business today. All these measures have one thing in common. They overcame orthodoxy in public policy, they represented bolder thinking, and that is what we need across government now. We need every cabinet minister, and especially the prime minister, leading a campaign for bolder growth. So we have some ideas on how to get them started. Five new ideas. First, We think we should use this moment to transform private sector investment. So how about we leverage the 6-point corporation tax increase shock of next April to stimulate unprecedented business investment and innovation? Any salesperson know that a price rise is a great time to do a discount. So when the super deduction ends in March 23, let's replace it with a permanent investment deduction, a 100% tax deduction for capital spending. That way, companies can straight away see the value of their investments in a lower tax bill. I want to see Rishi outside a car dealership speaking to camera saying, you can pay loads more tax if you want to, but why not invest more, pay less, grow your business, and serve your country? What are the chances of him doing that? Two, let's talk about skills. We have a new idea for new times. We totally get why the apprenticeship levy was introduced. Apprenticeships were the only options for technical skills. But today's reality is we have T-levels and higher technical qualifications and boot camps on top of apprenticeships. The government then was worried that UK businesses were spending too little on talent, or that the training was poor quality, or that we choose instead just to import the skills we needed. Well, I agree with all that, but it's ancient history now. Today, at every level, in every sector, and in every part of the country, firms are facing acute skills shortages. And the government is saying, we can't import them. We have to grow them overnight. Skills policy just isn't set up to deliver what we need, partly because the situation has changed so drastically. What employers need are rapid-fire, high-quality skills right now, and so do employees. So let's stop solving a 2010 problem. Let's start solving a 2030 problem. We need more money from firms, yes. Funding more British worker skills, yes, with a higher quality and more flexible offer. It's time to turn the apprenticeship levy into a skills challenge fund. We would allow businesses to buy training modules with their levy funds, not just full apprenticeship qualifications. We would allow greater flexibility on the types of training, and we'd incentivize and reward firms that go the extra mile to train their people with an upside kicker for those businesses that spend more than just their levy. And if we have that in place, I will join any government minister marching around the country urging businesses to invest more in their people. Third, we must go for green growth. And we must accelerate the plans, and the green, especially in the green markets, the green private sector markets, where Britain today leads the world, but may not for long. Three things the government must do now. One is to close the investment gap, in particular in those important green growth areas. Energy efficiency, for example, where we need an extra $3 billion a year to properly retrofit our homes and businesses and bring down everybody's energy bills, not just today, for 6 weeks' time, but for good. By the budget, we must publish the target model, business model, contract for difference in hydrogen. We've been waiting now for ages. We need to show the world that this is the place where they want to put their money to work in hydrogen. And thirdly, we should launch a scorecard for green competitiveness, to launch by government and business together, to hold ourselves accountable versus our competitor countries about how we're doing in the major green growth markets of the future. Fourth, and I hope you like this one, Robert, we need to take up the Brexit opportunity we now have on regulation. Contrary to popular opinion, we don't want a bonfire of regulations for business or divergence for the sake of it. This is about something altogether smarter. It's about leading the world in having the most future-focused regulatory environment. It's a vision where Britain, therefore, is the first to win in new and growing markets, AI, life sciences, and so on, and also the first to adapt in existing ones, transforming the UK into a global regulation rule setter. So today, we propose that the Prime Minister builds on his very good thinking in Monday's Brexit paper on regulation and sets up a new Office for Future Regulation. Now, I realise that doesn't sound that radical, but its mission would be. The focus of the new body would be specifically on the big bets we need to make in our economy. Regulation would be future-focused on new technology and new consumer realities. It would be more agile, changing when out of date, allowed to do so now that we don't have to negotiate it between 28 countries. It would be more proportionate, rooted in a better balance between investment and consumer protection. And finally, it would be more dynamic, and our regulators more dynamic, allowing them to be quick and decisive, just as we saw with the vaccine, when the MHRA enabled the UK to lead the world. Fifth and finally, let's get serious about having the workforce for the future. Last autumn, you may remember, business and government had a pointless quarrel over HGV drivers and butchers. The government ignored the obvious evidence that the UK couldn't train enough new ones in time at home. They said, tough luck, unless we close the borders, business will never change. Great rhetoric, poor results. So shall we get serious now about how we can generate more of the skills we need at home so we can rely less on immigration? Nadeem Zahawi, the Education Secretary, is on to something with his new Unit for Future Skills, designed to look at the data of the skills gaps in different industries. But let's go one step further. Let's supercharge that idea and build an independent council for future skills. What would it do? It would take a holistic look at our workforce needs for today and tomorrow, number one. Number two, work out how government policies can help us meet them. Number three, it would optimize, therefore, government training provision towards that future economic demand. And number four, it would give independent recommendations on where we'll need visas to overcome shortages in homegrown talent. It would therefore set the shortage occupation list whilst thinking about homegrown skills at the same time. It sounds impossible. How could the Home Office and the DfE collaborate? But it's now so obvious. And businesses can't take the government's immigration policy seriously until it shows a real plan for homegrown skills. So to finish, five ideas about how to think seriously about growth. That's just in one speech. Imagine if the CPS and all the other think tanks and our leading academics and our finest entrepreneurs were all invited by the Prime Minister to join a new campaign, Bolder Ideas for a Faster Growing Britain. Don't get me wrong, it's not all on government. This is a speech deliberately addressed to a political audience, but the CBI in the year ahead will be using every week, every month to promote serious growth to businesses across the country. We will ask them to increase investment in net zero, in innovation, in digital transformation, in exports, in skills, in the health and well-being of their workforce. And we will gather them in clusters around the country to deliver levelling up the only way it can be done, with the private sector creating better skills, jobs, and wages. But to government, I say, in closing, now is not a time to lowball our ambitions, to settle for a new normal of low growth. Better growth is the only real answer to the cost of living crisis, rising energy prices, high inflation. Better growth ensures that we as a country are not imprisoned in a cycle where we can't afford what we need and we can't raise taxes further to pay for it. Better growth ensures that every region, every nation, every corner of society can flourish, that a decade of low wages for many is not repeated, and that inequalities across the UK are reduced, not increased. So let's refuse to settle for policy convention. The best prime ministers and the best governments haven't. They have been radical reformers. I believe that UK business leaders have never been more serious about growth. After 6 years of reasons to wait, they are a coiled spring ready to pounce. We just need politicians to join us in making it so. After a disappointing economic decade past, this is our second chance. So let history show that we seize the moment. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. Now, we'll have a quick conversation and then hopefully open it up to everyone else before Rishi tells us how he's going to stop us all getting poorer in short order. So you touched on this right at the end, but one fundamental question I wanted to ask was whether this is a question of policy or culture, both in government and beyond. So people like me and obviously your team at the CBI, we come up with lots of clever ideas. We send them into government. Government comes up with lots of clever ideas. But at the same time, we've had several decades in which businesses in the UK haven't invested, you know, they haven't trained staff, they haven't exported, especially smaller firms. You know, government can and sometimes does turn around and say, well, look, we've tried this scheme and that scheme and the other scheme, and we've funded it, and we've not funded it, and we've, but at some point we have to say that the problem is cultural rather than being about the levers that we can pull in Whitehall.
Well, look, I mean, if it's cultural, as you said and I said, it wasn't always cultural. I mean, there is a bit of it that's sort of long term, but we've shown we can exceed our cultural norms. And let's say that it is cultural, because I understand that it's somehow endemic. The question is, who has the levers to change the culture? I mean, honestly, if the government's answer is, look, it's cultural, we're doomed for 1.3% growth forevermore, then we can all go home. But government have the handle on so many culture levers, right? That's what tax incentives are all about. It's what, you know, yesterday's Levelling Up white paper is all about. It's what the offshore wind story is all about. Look, I wish the CBI had all the levers, right? We would do all the things I just said. And by the way, we'll use our lever, right? We have a very nice pulpit, and we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of members, and we will campaign that they do these things too. But government controls the culture levers of our economy. Nadeem Zahawi on skills can wave a wand and the culture can change. Now, admittedly, the wand isn't directly connected to the behavior of every firm, but he's got a better chance than anyone in this room and than you or I. Yeah. So I think that, yes, it's cultural, but the levers to change culture are predominantly in the hands of government. And believe me, we will campaign with them on the follow through.
It just sometimes strikes me that we, to use a football metaphor, because I know we're both fans of a fine football team, we sometimes talk about it in terms of, you know, oh, we used the 4-4-2 formation when we should have had three at the back, rather than the some simpler, you know, we just didn't want it enough.
Ah, well, listen, now that we've got into football formations, with apologies to non-football fans, I think any good football team manager, God, it's so cliche to use sporting metaphors, but anyway, will tell you that you don't shift formation four times during a season. And that is the story of government industrial policy, as you well know.
Incentives would be the classic example.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but also, you know, we had an industrial strategy under this government, then we cancelled it, and then we sort of have one, but we have a plan for growth. And actually, you know, probably the most predominant complaint amongst firms the country over is that the governments, we've tried it, usually lasts for 9 months, and then there's a replacement of the business secretary, and we try something else. I remember Charlie Mayfield and I went to Germany to understand the German productivity miracle. And we had a sort of round table of German policymakers and chief executives. And they basically said industrial policy in Germany has been consistently the same for 70 years. And our industrial policy changes every 3 years, if not more often. So listen, I think for the government to turn around and say, no, we tried that. You know, we tried to tax, you know, I think if the Treasury turned around and said, well, we tried a super deduction, but, you know, in the wake of mass inflation, you know, energy prices soaring, and it only lasted 1 year. No, we tried that. Tax incentives don't work. I think that would be just not credible.
Yes. Well, I think temporary investment incentives alongside permanent tax rises probably definitely doesn't work.
Well, indeed.
You mentioned a few countries in there, Singapore, EU, I mean, Germany just now. Like, if you could pick and choose from what the best practice of other countries, apart from that consistency, which I think everyone here would agree is absolutely has been missing. I mean, I remember... you know, we had the list of grand challenges, and then we had the list. You know, and then basically every government seems to pick its sort of five favorite industries, which are the future, whether it's self-driving cars or, you know, and it's just like, yeah, there is no consistency. But if you could pick the stars of the show, the ones who we should be copying, where would you
look? I think I don't. What I envy amongst other countries, I think, is they are better than us at formulating a joint coalition between industry and government behind big bets, right? They do national competitiveness strategies, and they all align around them, and they work together on them. We're not very good at doing that in this country. But look, our inherent advantages, I mean, we have unique inherent advantages, right? If you look at all the sort of profit pools of growth in every market and sector in the next 10 years around the world, and we did last year, you'll see that all the big prizes are in areas like financial services and professional services and digital services. We're really good at that stuff, right? The world should be ours. When you look at where all the green growth is coming from, hydrogen, carbon capture, and so on, we currently are leaders in the world of that. I think this is about having the confidence and the courage to bet big and to not only bet big in words, which the government has done a lot of, but to bet big in actions, which they've only done occasionally. And I hope after today, and as they think about the next 3 years, and they think about that OBR forecast, which is miserable, if accurate, that they think, actually, we need to follow through on these big bets.
But there are some tensions here. Like, so you mentioned, of your 2 points, one was green growth and another was regulation. But if you read the regulation paper which came out on Monday, they explicitly say, we think a one-in-two-out target would be very good and it would have a galvanising effect throughout Whitehall, but we can't do it because we're doing net zero. And that's going to have so much new regulation that it would make it way too painful for us to then strip away lots of other regulation at the same time. Now, we obviously would object to that and say, you know, you can still do net zero and strip away existing wasteful regulation.
Look, I think there is definitely a ton of regulation and red tape which firms are struggling with, and definitely small and medium-sized firms are struggling with, and I hate to say it, but they are particularly struggling with it from Brexit because it's gone up in volume. Hopefully that will calm down. But actually, when you talk to sector leaders, either startup, high-growth, scale-up businesses, or the large companies, or you speak to the UK country managers of global businesses, they will tell you that the UK can really lead the way on smart regulation, future-focused regulation. The way we're going to compete in financial services, the way we're going to compete in life sciences, is because we are going to have high-standard, highly dynamic, and proportionate regulation. Is that one in, two out? I mean, it might be, but it might not be. It might be two in and one out. I mean, the net effect is that global companies look at Britain and say, God, that is a place where my life sciences business can flourish and grow, not only in the UK, but it can then export accordingly. That's the test. The test for me is not how many in and how many out. The test is, will global businesses turn around and say, Britain, now that's a place to build my business. Yeah.
And contradicting my first question, do you think we've got the caliber of people in Whitehall on this? Because obviously, I think the Unit for Future Skills is a very good idea. I think an Office for Future Regulation would be a good idea. We definitely need something in there pushing this. But if these units are staffed by the same people who've been staffing the existing regulators and coming up with the existing policies, you know, arguably nothing, you know, you're just changing the deck chairs.
Look, if the question is, do we have the talent in the country? Yes. Do they all work in Whitehall? No. But I wouldn't expect people in Whitehall to be, you know, the world's best experts in contract structuring for the hydrogen market. The truth is it exists in the private sector as well. What I think we are very bad at in this country, and I'm worried it's going to get worse, is having civil servants and government ministers working with businesses in the design of policy. Right? Government is, in this country, and I know from talking to my peers and others, is deeply concerned about capture and feels that business should contribute its thinking through formal consultations. Then Whitehall officials can circulate in a room with ministers and decide. What we don't have enough in this country is the sort of fluidity at the upstream stage. I realize there's vested interests over time in shaping policy with the best minds in the country. And my worry, by the way, Robert, is that's going to get even worse, right? The message from the Treasury, from most government departments right now is, okay, business, you know, wean yourself off the handouts, no more money, don't come asking us for anything. You know, there's a lot of closed doors in Whitehall to business right now. We're not going to design future solutions for your future industries that way.
And again, one pushback on that would be slightly, when government and business get in the same room, it tends to be big government and big business that get in the same room. You mentioned SMEs, and obviously small and family businesses is a really huge part of what we're doing at the CPS. How do you ensure, I mean, as the, you know, obviously, you know, there's a fox and a hen house thing, but as the CBI is an organisation made up primarily of bigger businesses, how do you ensure that the voice of SMEs is still heard, and that you're not, when you're designing regulation, for example, you're designing regulation that accommodates challenge as opposed to incumbency.
Yeah, look, by the way, we regard ourselves as the voice of all business, and we have spent most of the last 2 years putting forward policies on, for example, COVID that frankly were of no effect for big businesses. They were about small businesses. But to your point, look, I think, you know, I know enough about this government to know that they are much more interested in unicorn businesses and smaller businesses than they are in big companies. They see their role as unlocking that kind of flourishing amongst our economy. Now, when it comes back to regulation design, it's a good question. I mean, my view is that our regulation should be designed to help Britain flourish and innovate, right? It's not just help incumbents flourish, it's to help British business innovate. And so we should have room for innovation and innovators. you need to be smart about it. I mean, we've just seen in the energy market what's happened, right, in the last 6 months, right, which is we tried to design regulation to bring in loads and loads of brand new energy companies, all of whom, because of our price cap, then have collapsed. And now we're back having a conversation about how many energy companies can we have in this country. But I absolutely accept the point of what you're saying. We need to design regulation so that the fintechs, you know, if necessary, the fintechs will outdo the banks, or the banks should outdo the fintechs. We shouldn't design regulation for one or another. We should design regulation to make sure this is the best place for financial, digitally inspired financial services in the world.
Cool. Well, if we open it up now to questions, and if someone can wave frantically when we're about to hit Rishi's timing. The first question submitted in advance from Lisha Johnson from Investec, which is, considering growth is such a broad term, what are the key drivers that should receive most focus in order to raise growth?
Where's Alpesh when you need him, our lead economist? I think the one that we have always said that is totally missing from the UK story is business investment. UK is actually pretty good at consumption, right? And if you look right now, what's happening?
Insanely
right?
good at consumption. Right?
People are going out and spending. I bet you've all bought an unbelievably expensive coffee on your way in this morning, right? We spend money well. As citizens.
So just to interrupt you, in case people haven't seen it, there's a fascinating chart of during the pandemic, how people transferred their spending from services to goods. Basically, how many, like, just switched to just buying stuff from Amazon. And the UK is astonishingly higher than any other country. In fact, the Treasury's big worry about a further lockdown, someone there was telling me, was that people would just run out of room for Amazon boxes and the economy would finally collapse.
Yeah. You've been to my house. I think so. It's all about business investment. And when you compare us to OECD countries on consumption, we do great. Business investment, we're poor. And I honestly believe that, yes, that is, as you've said, it has been a recurring part of our business culture. But it really could change this time. We have this unique advantage, I can't imagine it was by design, where for 6 years, companies haven't invested anything because Brexit uncertainty and what kind of Brexit deal, and then the pandemic hit. And I can tell you from talking to our members, and if you look at all the surveys, the investment readiness, the investment consideration is really strong right now. And I do think that little bit of nudge theory from the Chancellor, I think you'll see a really good story in business investment, and that's the growth driver I worry about. And by the way, we also need to be worried about overheating the economy, right? I mean, you know, we've got a lot of inflation, got high levels of consumption. I don't think all of a sudden now we should be trying to stimulate consumption. We'll see what happens with the cost of living crisis. But I think we should now start to think about stimulating business investment so that 1.3 is already on track to be higher. Because I tell you something, unlike consumption, where you can, you know, pass a VAT cut today and tomorrow everyone goes to the shops, right? You don't pass a business incentive today and then all of a sudden, you know, it just takes a bit of time.
Yeah, and if you look at those OBR figures, the reason it's 1.3 and then 1.6, 1.7 is basically entirely driven by business investment and a prediction that it falls off a cliff in 23, 24, which is obviously not
I ask you a question?
Of course.
Because I'm sitting here doing all the talking and you are an absolute expert in some of this stuff. I am watching with interest how the Conservative Party grapples with these two conflicting interests right now, fiscal conservatism, you know, the end of debt and deficit, and cut taxes to stimulate growth. Can you just give us a brief treatise on those two Conservative principles and which one should win at a time like this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I always say that political parties, like, you know, come to resemble their owners, like, you know, dogs resembling their owners. And under Boris Johnson, the Tory party, like the British public, is essentially cakeist. It wants to spend lots of money and cut lots of taxes. And I think we are reaching the limits of that position in terms of the size of the state, the whole context of our discussion, the size of the state and the amount that you can take in tax are just now getting out of whack on a sort of permanent level. I mean, I think, if you look at, it's not just so recently in the pandemic, the constituency for fiscal discipline and for sort of traditional free market economics within the Tory party is actually probably smaller than it has been for quite a while. You know, the complaints to the Chancellor when he delivers his budget are not, you are spending too much money, it's my constituency is not getting enough. Paul Goodman at Conservative Home told me that they have had more articles from MPs on the wonders of net zero, and in particular, this amazingly good £100 million investment scheme for my constituency than on everything else kind of almost put together. And I think on net zero, there's a real kind of moment when it turns from being about handing out goodies to constituencies to everyone paying more in their bills that suddenly that's the moment when the agenda's going to come under pressure. I think, but I think it is a real tension. And you saw that in the cabinet debate. I mean, very loosely, sort of Sunak versus Truss, that you know, when they're talking about the NI rise, Truss says, look, let's just put it on borrowing. It's not Tory to do this. And Sunak says, no, we can't hand down debt to a future generation. It's not Tory to do that. And I think that's a really powerful debate, and it's a really, really live debate. And it actually reflects the Thatcher-Reagan divide, that the traditionally the American conservatives were entirely unworried about deficits because they believed the future would be better because we would have growth. Whereas British conservatives, like Thatcher and her ilk, were entirely pessimistic about the future. They believed the country was on a slow decline. Therefore, you could not possibly hand on deficits to a future generation because you'd be making things that much worse. And I think that tension is very much there. I think Boris himself will obviously always tend more towards the more kind of Henry VIII style, let's spend more, let's cut taxes and worry about the future later element.
But, you know, he's more Reagan than Thatcher.
I think he is definitely more Reagan than Thatcher on this stuff.
Yeah. Great.
And Andrew from Barclay, but I mean, please ask me any more questions. But
yeah, wait for the mic.
I'll sit down, so I'm not in the way of the camera. So I was going to ask a question about corporation tax rates, because on Monday of this week, John Mulryan of Ballymore pointed out to the Housing Select Committee that in Ireland he faced a corporate tax rate of 12.5%, which is soon going to become 25% in London. Plus an effective rate of 6% for the residential property developer tax because it's corporation tax on pre-finance costs, plus another unknown amount for the building safety levy every time you put a new building into production. So in London, he's going to face an effective rate of 30 to 35%, whereas in Dublin, it's going to be 12.5%. But as a little supplementary to that, because I think that the problems here were covered quite well in your speech, had a lot of very good ideas in it. This morning, the boss of Iceland was asked on Radio 4 how you would supercharge levelling up. And what he said was planning. He can't get anything through planning anywhere because of a lack of the basics. There are not planning officers in local councils. So my question is, are we at the risk of not doing the basics right? So you get all these really big industrial plans, but there just isn't a planning officer in the local council. So you can't get anything done. Are we, to go back to your football analogy, practicing our bicycle kicks rather than just passing?
We need Alan Hansen and Gary Neville now, don't we? So there's lots there. Look, first of all, on corporation tax and effective tax rates. I mean, I think that's absolutely right? When you look at the effective business tax rate in this country rather than the corporation tax, which the Treasury would have you do, the argument falls apart. And so the government will continue to say, but corporation tax is competitive. But when you layer on effective taxes that businesses pay compared to other places, we really aren't. We really aren't. I think that's a little bit of politics. That's political presentation, but I think it's wrong.
Yeah. No, you're right. The Treasury's position essentially is that international investors who are utterly wonderful and incredibly sophisticated are also stupid enough that they only pay attention to to the headline tax rate rather than the overall tax burden.
I think you're right about planning. You know, it is a long-standing UK problem, and the fact that it's a resource problem now is deeply frustrating. Right? If it was planning law, people were mostly complaining about, then fair enough. Parliamentary time coming, but a lot of people are complaining about just backlogs. Right? They are complaining about backlogs. By the way, a lot of regulators are complaining they don't have the resource to do leading edge regulation. So, look, I think there is a little bit of false economy that goes on that's worth thinking about. Look, I think in general, and here's Andy, our head of international trade, he and I spend a lot of time talking to global companies about Britain's proposition. And at a superficial level, Britain is a fantastic place to invest, right? Rule of law, English language, London's a great city to live, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we're at risk of taking that for granted. We're at risk of being complacent because we have those fundamentals in place. Those fundamentals, in my view, give us the right to be a top 10 economy. They don't give us the right to be a top 5 economy. They don't give us the right to be able to earn money in and of itself for everybody around the country in high growth industries and high growth jobs. There's some extra work to do. So I think our competitiveness is a daily challenge. I think it should be a question at every single budget. And correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, it was supposed to be what Brexit was about. In the first place, yes, sovereignty. But in the second place, realizing far more competitiveness for Britain outside the European Union. So I think this government should be obsessed with UK competitiveness in the decade ahead.
Yes, I'd agree with that. On planning, for sure, I mean, there's another constraint which is going to happen, which is that, you know, after COVID, depending on how many, where it eventually shakes out in terms of working from home, but we are going to need to regenerate and rethink pretty much every city centre, town centre, high street in the country, and, you know, get a lot more homes in there and a lot fewer shops. Even before COVID hit, you had areas, the areas most in need of levelling up, incidentally, the areas which also swung most of the Tories in the election, where, you know, you had vacancy rates which were, you know, just eye-poppingly high. And, you know, being able to change that isn't just about being able to make change of use really easy, which they've done some stuff on. It's being able to actually draw up really good plans, get businesses involved in drawing up the plans rather than just councillors, and put them in place. And, you know, how many people are there in the country who can draw up really good plans for city centres? Not many. So, you know, they're going to make a fortune out of this. But, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of quite bad plans that are drawn up, or we're all going to have to wait for years of empty shops and empty high streets.
Robert, can I ask you about the Conservative Party and the green agenda? Mm-hmm. So when you say the green agenda amongst business, people see pound signs these days, right? When we had a big team up at COP, and COP was swarmed. Glasgow was swarmed. I mean, all the policy people were inside the secure zone. The rest of Glasgow was business people, big and small. And professional services, financial services, you know, there's a lot of small manufacturers optimizing their business now in order to fit in green supply chains. They see new opportunities. So businesses, of course, there are some deadlines and there is some ambiguity and there may be some cost involved. But most businesses see the green evolution just like the digital evolution, which is it's going to happen, and the faster you move to it, the more money you're going to make. And yet, I'm not sure. I think there's a wing in the Conservative Party that don't see it that way.
I think there is a wing in the Conservative Party. That said, Frank Luntz, the great American pollster, came over and did a whole great big project for us last year on attitudes to business, attitudes to politics. And it was not good reading for politicians. It was not good reading for businessmen. I mean, both factions are roundly despised by the public, I'm afraid. But one of the things he found, and which he hasn't found in any other country, and it's blown up by all the other evidence, Britain has the strongest cross-party consensus on the environment of any country. In pretty much every comparable country, greenery is a left-right issue. Think of the Republicans, Democrats, or the situation in Australia, or even, you know, what's happening in quite a lot of Europe. That is, you know, the British are the most likely to be keen on climate action, the most willing to accept it, and in fact, in some respects, Conservative voters are keener on it than Labour voters. That said, the attachment of voters of any kind to this stuff is fairly shallow. I think the answer to the question, would you be prepared for your gas bills to go up in order to help decarbonize? The number of Conservative voters who say yes on that, I think from memory, is 8 or 9%. The number of Labour voters who say yes is 15 or 16%. Net zero is incredibly popular. Individuals paying for net zero through their cost of living is incredibly unpopular. And that is a circle that can only be squared by innovation, technology, businesses doing wonderful things. Hydrogen, we are huge fans of hydrogen as well. We've done a paper on it. It's not just that this is the way to make profit. It's like literally the only way this happens without a backlash.
And by the way, look, the UK, I can tell you already, and I've had this conversation with the Treasury and with Kwasi and with Number 10, the UK is not going to compete in public investment terms with our competitors. We are being wildly outspent on green. But we can't afford not to compete on green, right? We've got large institutional investors with 130 trillion to spend, and we need it to come here. The way we compete is by creating green private sector markets, like we've done in offshore wind, that attracts very high levels of private sector investment. We could win that, but we are going to need government's conservative small c stance on these things to shift very quickly, because we are getting outspent, out-subsidized by other countries who are essentially throwing money at companies to build electric cars, at companies to build wind turbines. We have to compete. I don't know why I'm preaching to you. You're nodding. Let's get more questions in.
Hi, Andy Burwell, International Director at CBI. Without making any comments about the political or economic systems in China or other fast growth economies, one of the commonalities of those fast growth economies is consistent political leadership and also the integration of the state and business in a system which obviously wouldn't necessarily work in a democratic state. But obviously the UK and many democracies have a cyclical political system. We've got another election looming in 2024, perhaps before. How do we, and maybe this question for Robert, get beyond the politics and that political cycle in making these incremental commitments? And what can business do to support that longer-term thinking?
Well, I mean, I think the shine has slightly come off both China's growth model and its political, what shine its political model had in recent years. You're right, and I was struck by this during the 2017 and 2019 elections. What you had going up against each other were utterly, fundamentally different versions of how an economy and society should be ordered, and in a way that it's impossible to imagine in say Germany or another country. It's the point Tony made about consistency of a policy, but it's not just even sort of between parties. It's not been commented on enough that, like, the central core of Rishi Sunak's economic agenda is to literally do the opposite to what George Osborne did. Osborne slashed investment incentives in order to lower headline rates of corporation tax. Sunak did precisely the opposite. And both of them thought that they were doing what the evidence said and what the best thing, you know, the best thing for long-term growth. But you know, the investment allowance has just gone. It's kind of wibbled and wobbled more than a jelly on a plate. Ultimately, you need a shared buy-in around this is the kind of country we're going to be, and I'd like that to be. We are the most competitive, the lowest tax, the best regulated. You know, we are the most business-friendly and investment-friendly country on the planet. And I'd like, and then we can use the old phrase, share the proceeds of growth. We could use that to ensure that growth is not just. It's concentrated in London and the southeast, but spread throughout the country, and that we have really world-class firms and services, pretty much everywhere. But there's just something about our political cycle, and I think that's partly been exacerbated by Brexit, which and the financial crisis, both of which are moments where you have to say, okay, the previous model isn't working, but then you don't. Then what do you replace it with? And
I mean, just to comment on that, I think it is. I mean, in theory, this is a government with a very large majority. And therefore, that's your best chance, in my experience, of getting decade-long thinking. So I guess question for you, do you think there is decade-long thinking in government to create real sort of lasting post-Brexit, new economic thinking change? And it's also, by the way, one of the reasons why I think politically green is the most interesting growth opportunity, because actually the UK government has sort of put a target in the ground, 2035, 2030, we've got in political terms, very long-term targets, and climate terms are very aggressive targets. That gives you an anchor by which you can structure market opportunity. It's one of the few areas in which there could be consistent long-term policy. So I think that's an argument for Green, but I just wonder whether or not you think the government has been bold enough in having a 10-year agenda rather than just a, get through the next year agenda.
Well, we saw yesterday it does have a 10-year agenda, because now there is this big list of 12 things that by 2030 it is committed to doing, including creating a globally competitive city in every region of the UK, which I was slightly puzzled by, because I sort of feel either you've already got a globally competitive city in that region, or you're not going to create one within 8 years. It is slightly unfair to be levelling that charge because of the pandemic, right? There were obviously plans, and there was obviously long-term thinking, and then suddenly this asteroid has come and has smashed the public services, it smashed the public finances, and you can't blame them for the fact that we are still kind of crawling out of the ditch and looking at the wreckage of our house behind us.
Look, I think that's right. Although it's amazing how fast countries around the world are already moving on to the growth agenda. And I think we're just being slower.
We have time for one more question, I think.
Wait, the mic's coming, just so everyone can hear you online.
Thank you. Jeff Skingsley, L'Oreal. One tax you haven't mentioned is business rates. And we talk about growth. There's also growth on the high street that needs to be re-stimulated for small businesses, such as salons, beauty parlors, because there's 250,000 people employed in those. They had a terrible COVID and lockdown. And the business rates break on their investment is a real problem. So it would be good to add the business rates into the list of taxes that were...
Well, I did actually. When I talked about, you know, fourth highest, we're the fourth worst in the OECD when it comes to property taxes. I was talking about business rates completely.
Okay.
And I talked to with Michael Gove 2 days ago about business rates and the levelling up plan, because you're completely right? I mean, I think the Prime Minister has rightly observed that at a very human level, you know, boarded up high streets, diminishing high streets, absolutely dents the confidence of a place. Mm. Whereas thriving high streets brings it alive. And momentum, there's a lot about momentum in levelling up. And I will allow him and the Chancellor to discuss it further. Let's just put it like that. I mean, the Chancellor is under no illusions what we think about business rates. We've been driving him mad for 2 years. But I think you're absolutely right. Business rates that allow for thriving high streets is, I mean, if levelling up isn't about that, what is it about?
But there's an interesting example of Treasury brain here, where they're saying, okay, we'll cut business rates, but we'll tax online sales instead, because it's like the money has to come from somewhere, rather than thinking, okay, we've got this area that's kind of not growing as quickly, but we have an area that's growing, let's grab the money from the area that's growing, which I'm not terribly keen on as a strategy. Tony, I'm really sorry. We could stay here. I'm talking all day, but I am getting signals that Rishi is about to stand up and unveil his latest. Relief package for the nation. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Robert.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Very good. Thanks, everybody.